Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour on Monday, October 27th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, and I'm looking forward to tonight's program, so I'm glad you've joined me for it. It's really getting dark early now. I seem to always have to mention that. And Halloween is this coming Friday. And on Sunday, daylight savings time ends here in the United States. So we are truly moving into the winter and darker time of the year. And the good thing about that is we get to move our clocks back on Sunday, and I always do like that. Going on to my topic for tonight, it's another quite sensitive one, but I'm determined to carry it on without apologies. I've had two comments this week from a person named Jesse at my website, who's a very likable person, and told me that he was Polish, but he still liked my programs and listened to me and liked to read my website, but it made him feel kind of bad when I say the things I do about Poles, and I don't want to hurt his feelings or the feelings of others like him, because definitely there's never the case that all people are alike. If I speak highly of the German people, I'm certainly aware that there are a lot of rotten Germans and bad Germans and people that I don't approve of. So it's not that in any group it's all one of a kind, but there's just certain things going on in history, and I think that the historical truth needs to be defended and needs to be discussed. So that's what this is all about tonight. I'm going to say that my motive for this show is, well, information that I've come upon, and then underlying that is that I would, what do I think I can gain from it, you might ask. Well, what I do want is to, if possible, or do whatever I can, even if it's not possible, but at least try to stop the ravings and the constant lying of Polish chauvinists who insist on blaming Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist Party for stealing, robbing, and otherwise swindling Poles out of their, quote, historic homelands, unquote, and also for all the crimes that he supposedly, in his party, in his government, in his allies, supposedly carried on against Poles in what they call the Holocaust. That's where I'm coming from, and I would start out by saying that I question whether Poles are really a racial people, but maybe an expression of the, rather than a race, an expression of the Catholic Church. The people migrating from the East and who settled in the East of Europe are supposedly Slavic people. They've been given that name. They're not all the same people, but They developed languages which were similar and considered now to be the Slavonic language group, which ties them together. The people like the Poles were a migrating people. We were all migrating people at one time or another, of not all that well-known origin, and they were actually, what distinguished them was that they were baptized into the Catholic faith by this person named, by Miesko, I guess that's how you pronounce it, so I'm going to pronounce it, M-E-I-S-Z-K-O, Miesko, who actually was a Norwegian who was under the protection, who came under the protection of the Pope in the Vatican because he confessed and allowed himself to be baptized as a Catholic. So I'm going to go into that in just a minute, a little bit more into that history and the questions about it. Then the language came later. But in any event, I want to mention something from my a radio program I did just about a little over 1 year ago on October 5th, 2013. And it is, I don't have the title of it. It was about the Action Reinhardt camps and such. And in that, it gave some, you know, history of that and about the Holocaust type program. And in that, I talked about Jan Karski, who is a very well-known Polish underground, Polish hero from the Polish underground, and ended up as a Georgetown University professor in the United States. He is billed himself and was billed as the man who discovered the Holocaust, something like that. And his real name was Kozielewski, something like that. And he was Polish. He managed to lift himself from an ordinary lieutenant in the Polish army to the man who tried to stop the Holocaust. All right, that's how he builds himself. And he wrote a book with that title about himself, The Man Who Tried to Stop the Holocaust. And he really told a whole lot of big lies and stories, fibs, and so on about what he saw. And he did this in starting in 1943, so not that much was known, but he invented a whole lot of things that were passed around at the time that nobody would really believe today. They don't fit the story today, but it has not disproved, you know, has not discouraged people or from thinking that he was a great man who did all this work to help the Poles and prevent the Holocaust or tell about the Holocaust. And it says that one of the things he invented was the death by quicklime in rail cars at Belzec rather than at gas chambers. He said that all these Jews were being killed while they were being transported in rail cars that were filled with lime. And they died from breathing in and being covered with lime, quicklime. And that story, though, as far as Holocaust lore goes, has been buried along with so many others. But it has not, as I said, taken away from the luster of Karski. Karski was the name he was given because he was working for the Polish underground. And here's something that I just saw today from Wikipedia. In 1942, Karski, this is directly quoting from Wikipedia, Karski was selected by Cyril Ratajski, which is the Polish name, the Polish government delegate's office at home, that's where he was from, to perform a secret mission to Prime Minister Władysław Sikorski in London. Now we know that this Sikorski was a very well-known Pole who was in the, he was, what's that called? You know, he'd setting up their Free Poland or something in London. And they had a whole bunch of them were there and they were, you know, doing their thing from London with the help of the blessings of the British. And so Karski was selected by this Ratajski to contact Sikorski, as well as other Polish politicians, and inform them about Nazi atrocities in occupied Poland, because he said he had knowledge of these things. He had been spying and so on. So in order to gather evidence, Karski met with Jewish Labor Bund in Poland activist Leon Feiner. Leon Feiner is a Jew, and he was the with the Bund, what they call it, the Bund, but it turns out the Bund is the Jewish Labor Bund in Poland. That's the full name of it. And with the help of these Jews, he was twice smuggled, it says, by Jewish underground leaders into the Warsaw Ghetto for the purpose of directly observing what was happening to Polish Jews. And also disguised as an Estonian camp guard, he visited what he thought was the Belzec death camp, or the Belzec transit camp. In actuality, it seems that Karski only managed to get close enough to witness a Durchgangslager, which is I didn't pronounce that right, but it's a sorting and transit point. He managed to get to a sorting and transit point, which is what Belzec was. For Belzec, in the town of Izbica Lubelska, located midway between Lublin and Belzec, but he thought that he was at a death camp, and he somehow said that what he saw, which he couldn't have seen, he said he saw these people in trains with quicklime and things like that. And many historians have actually accepted this theory that he got a little confused about what he had seen, as Karski himself did later, because what he had said became obviously untrue. That's how they got around it. I am mentioning this because this is just another story of the way the Poles have got so carried away with getting back at the Germans, you might say, and although I don't know what you could just say is getting back at them, but making the Germans out to be doing mass murder and mass extermination and so on, and working with the Jews in order to do that, and quite willingly working with the Jews. Now Poles say they're so anti-Semitic. Oh, and you know, they managed to get rid of a whole lot of those Jews that were there, and that's thanks to the Germans, but they don't thank the Germans for it. In fact, they will hold the Germans guilty for harming their Jews every bit as much as they think they harmed the Poles there. So it's a confusing bit of dishonesty going on. Now, to get started with this, I'm going to start with The Image of the German in Polish Literature by Elz Loser, who I brought up in last week's program, I guess it was. That was Hitler and the Slavs 2, and this is Hitler and the Slavs 3 tonight. I thought about giving it a different title, but I thought, well, I settled on just carrying on with this same one with numbered, and I might end up doing a number 4 yet. Who knows? I've got more to talk about with this, so I very likely will. But each one stands on its own still. But I do include Hitler in this show to enough extent that I think it fits. So Elz Loser is a woman who's almost a contemporary, but she was born quite a long time ago. She wrote these things in the early 1980s, must have been working on it maybe in the 1970s. I cannot say, because it just says published in 1982, and she's got a copyright 1981. But it's a lot of work that she did, so she couldn't have just done it all of a sudden. She grew up in Silesia, and she and her family were caught in the Polish after 1919, by being made to be part of the Polish state. They were, of course, German, and thought they lived in Germany, but then the borders changed, and they were put into the Polish state, and they weren't too happy about it, but she experienced a lot of these things herself, personally. And she writes, or I've taken from what she wrote here, she writes that all Polish history books, indeed, all Polish literature, including the so-called Letter of Reconciliation from the Polish bishops Stefan Wyszynski and Karol Wojtyla. This Karol Wojtyla is the one who became Pope John Paul II, was it? Anyway, Pope John Paul, the Polish pope that was in office for such a long time, around that time. And these bishops, when he was still a bishop, let's see, they wrote this letter of reconciliation to the German bishops in 1956, you see, after the war, after we were supposed to be in the Germany and Poland were supposed to be reconciling, and they refer to this Mieszko I as the first Polish duke who took the Holy Sacrament of baptism in the year 966. I'm going to go through some of this history, but I don't just what I have here, the way I've got this organized, is that I've got her comments first. So she says that this fact that he was baptized, that he took the Holy Sacrament of baptism in 966, constitutes proof that no Polish Empire existed in 966. That was the very first, that was the first Poles that were recognized, because that was he was the first. And furthermore, she says that history shows that he was not a Pole, but rather a Norman named Dago Mesico from the Norwegian family line of the Daglingers, Daglingers, who migrated into land settled by the Germans on the Weichselen-Vorta rivers. His baptism in the Catholic Church proves nothing at all, certainly not that he was a Pole or that he ever became a Pole. It only proves that Dago accepted Christianity. And she says there are no records, as scholars confirm today, which ever mention even once a people bearing the name Poles or Slavs in the area at that time. If a Polish person really existed from a racial point of view, then it must have fallen down out of the sky without any racial ancestors, a Polish miracle without parallel. Of course, when the name Poles in Poland came about is difficult to discover, because there are a lot of fanciful stories, and I believe that the history of these particular people and of, I'll just say it that way, there's a lot of invention going on, you see, and so you can't really depend on what they write as history. Everything that I've read that I found that gives any supposed information about this is all by Polish writers with Polish names. All of it, except people who work for the Poles, like Norman Davies, who was a journalist who seemed to have been paid to write a bunch of things and write books and so on. And I'm going to talk about him in a little bit, but. To carry on with Elsa, she says the only tribes which were native to the area were Germanic, and the founders of the Polish Empire were also German. But Polish history has to begin somewhere, and it was therefore logical to take this Christian baptism as the point of departure. The falsifiers of history, and that's what she calls the people who invented, she says, the Polish history, who came along very much later, were simple men who lived mostly for the present, as is the case at all times. They lacked experience in falsification and failed to realize that their falsifications would be recognized as such. Boy, we see that. I talk about that with people today, like children who think they can get away with their lives by pretending that they're innocent, and, you know, people don't see through it. But she says these people could hardly imagine that research into the truth would ever begin, even after 1,000 years. Now I'm going to switch over to another writer that I'm going to be taking information from tonight, and that is Bertram de Colonna, who has written the book Inside Poland, and I've linked to it previously, and I will link to it again, but he wrote this in 1939, and Bertram de Colonna, despite his Italian last name, was a British or an Englishman, and he was traveling. He traveled in Poland in 1939 extensively and wrote all about it, left before September. He was there in like June and July, and maybe earlier than that too. Before that, but he was there then, and he wrote everything. He wrote about what he saw there, and his book is available online, and I finished reading it, and it's not so long, but it's vastly interesting, and he does appear to be an unprejudiced observer, actually writing what he saw and experienced. And he wrote in 1939. In Poland, that Poland's claim to be a great realm is based upon what is said to be history. What is said to be history, notice, the Poles state that their country once stretched to the very center of Europe, but the truth is that the Slavonic groups distributed thinly throughout this area and were by no means all Polish. Amongst the Slavs who were distributed thinly were not all, and still we have not figured out how it was ever determined why that somebody was Polish and wasn't, but I'm going to come up with my ideas in a minute. He writes, the mere fact that a few families settled for a while in this or that district does not offer a good basis for a legal claim on the part of a state. Historically, Poland first made her mark in the 10th century when she was a kind of vassal state linked up with the German Empire. Well, now I go to, that kind of corroborates what Elsa Loser has written. And now I'm going to go to, of course, I go to Wikipedia to see what they say about it. And you have to really be careful when you're reading Wikipedia. But they say around 400 BC, Poland was being, now see, there's no Poland. They're calling this area Poland, but it wasn't anything like 400 BC. It wasn't Poland, but it was being, this area was being settled by Celtic arrivals, and they were soon followed by a strong Germanic component, which is Wiki's writers say is influenced first by the Celts and then by the Roman Empire. But these Germanic people migrated out of the area by 500 AD. That's a long time later, from 400 BC to 500 AD. And then the wooded regions to the north and east were settled by the Balts, and that would be the people that we call the Baltics, Lithuanian and Latvian. And that the Slavic people have been in this territory for over 1,500 years. They were organized into tribal units, and many of the tribes are found on the list compiled by the anonymous Bavarian geographer in the 9th century. Now, this is another questionable thing that you find in this so-called history, because this was written, again, by Poles. I find that the epithet Bavarian geographer, in quotes, is a conventional name for the anonymous author of a Latin medieval text containing a list of the tribes in central Eastern Europe. It's called A Description of Cities and Lands North of the Danube. And the name Bavarian Geographer was first bestowed in 1796 by Polish count and scholar Jan Potocki. So, you know, this is not very old, although the paper or the manuscript that they found that they think is genuine, comes from, is fairly old, but the 9th century, no, yeah, 9th century, but it was in the 18th century, at the end of it, 1796, that this was identified as being by somebody called the Bavarian geographer, and it was a Polish man who did that, so the Poles are put a lot of store in this. The document wasn't discovered until 1772 in the Bavarian State Library in Munich. It could have been placed there, it seems to me, but I'm not going to go into that. But it was discovered by a Frenchman, and the French are always, by that time, were already very, very close friends with the Poles. The document was much discussed in the early 19th century. And anyway, it contains a list of the tribes in central Eastern Europe, east of the Elbe and north of the Danube, and some other directions given here. But absent on the list are Polans, Pomeranians, and Masovians. Those are ones that are areas that are considered to be Polish, but they're not on this list, and there's no, these tribes are not on the list, but these are the ones who are believed to have settled first on the Warta River during the 8th century. See, but again, it says this source needs translation. Now, one after another, all the sources for all this information here starts to say source needs translation, and the reason for that is because they're all in Polish. And they're all written by a person with a Polish name, and the titles are Polish. And Wikipedia understands that most people don't know Polish, and they can't find that information. And so they want it to be translated so that, we know what they're saying, but they haven't been. This is one way that they hide the fact that the sources that they give are not any good, and there's tons and tons of sources on Wikipedia that aren't good if you seek them out. But if you can't, even if it's in a language and that's not widely used at all and can't make it out really, it doesn't help to put that source there. So that's a good way to hide things. Anyway, the whole point of this is that the provenance of the document is disputed, and that's said straight out. And that it was, it seems to have been taken from the Codex Regenbertinius II, recorded in the 9th century in the library in the Reichenau Abbey. That's Germany. So only point I want to make from this, and I don't want to talk about it anymore, is that it's all questionable whether this history has anything to it, where they really know anything about this history or a history, or whether it's mainly been put together since. It has been put together in more recent times to create a history for the Polish people. And I think that is what I suspect, and that's what Elsa Loser is putting forth. And even Bertram Colonna is suspicious of it, but he's not going to say anything more than that about it. Now, this brings me to compare at this point the Poles and the Jews. And I've done it before, but kind of casually, we know that the Jews, the Poles are suspected of inventing their history by a lot of people. There's nothing very clear about it, and it's all written later on by Polish people. It was, it's all been put together, and that is the way the Jews operated. Is that not so? The Hebrews, when they were exiled to Babylon, and all the priests there got together, and the rabbis, whatever, and they started, while they were there, they had access to the big libraries in Babylon. They were treated quite well. The ones who were, considered I don't know if you could call them educated at that time, but the leaders and the brainy ones, what have you, the more scholarly types, who could access this information and learn languages and so on. So they were allowed to do all this while they were there over many, many years. I cannot say right now how many years. I'm just winging this. But they wrote the history of the Jewish people while they were there. And then that was, was established from what they wrote, that this was the history. The Jewish people didn't have the kind of history that they were given. And and we're going to find a lot of similarities, as I've already brought up, mentioned it a few times, between Poles and Jews. Now, we know that Poland has had more Jews than any other country in the world, I guess, mixed in amongst their population. They had picked up a lot from that. And a lot of Polish people say, good Polish people who are open to the truth and don't want to perpetuate lies, say that all these bad Poles, all these Poles that are you know, promoting the Holocaust and all these just polls that they think they don't like, are all Jews. I've heard a number of them say that. If a Pole is no good, it's because he's really a Jew. And they say Poland is full of Jews who have become Christians, crypto-Jews. And I can believe that up to a point. I don't know that all Poles like this are, it's because they're Jews. But Jews have an influence. I think, though, that there's a lot of similarity of behavior, and I'm going to be pointing that out as we go along, and at the rate I'm going, I'm just barely begun here, and I've got a ton more, and I hate to put it off, so I might be doing a three-hour show here tonight. I'm very sorry to have to do that, but for those who are willing to, I guess, stick with it, that's what it'll have to be, and if you don't want to, you can listen to the first part of it. But anyway, to get back to the history, we have this Mieszko the First, and it says, according to the Wikipedia history, that during the Piast dynasty rule of the 10th to the 14th century, Poland was formed and established as a state and a nation. The Piast dynasty was an order of the Catholic Church. It was a religious order, educational religious order that lasted. It's still going, you know. It's still a Catholic Church order. They specialize in establishing education wherever they go, you know, educational institutions and so on. That would be Catholic, for Catholics. And supposedly, they baptized this Mieszko person in 963, and there's a record of his baptism, or 966, one or the other. And I don't want to say what's not necessary here. And he was placed under the protection of the Pope. And it says that that his country was placed under the protection of the Pope. But see, I don't think that's right, because he didn't have a country. He had, you know, arrived there as a traveler, and he had gotten in with the church and the this Piast order, and they obviously liked him, and he liked them, and he was seen as then the someone who could baptize a whole lot of people, and I think that it was Mieszko's. What Mieszko was doing was finding a lot of the people around there who they call them Poles, but they might have later, much later, those who followed them, their future generations, might have become Poles, but they weren't Poles then. But they were being baptized. And the big thing about the Polish people is what strong Roman Catholics they are. And I don't know that you can hardly distinguish between the Roman Catholic Church and the Polish nation. The two are just linked together. So I see the beginning of this as, I'm putting forth, as converting these pagan people, whoever they could, to Catholicism and getting them baptized, and then they remained followers of Mieszko and the Piast order. Because they're calling this whole time, the 10th to the 14th century, the Piast dynasty rule, whatever that means. Most of the time they don't hardly know. But, you know, it's like doctors with their diseases and so on. And they have to name things. Historians have to name things. So, you know, as they're going along and they're finding out this and that, or trying to piece things together, they're naming. You know, this was this dynasty, this was this period of time, and this had this name, and that. It helps to create order in the whole thing, but it doesn't mean that it was, that is a true reflection, a true description of what was actually going on then. Now, after Mieszko came Boleslaw, and he was supposed to be Boleslaw the First, and supposedly he established a Polish church province and was officially crowned at the end of his life in 1025, becoming the first king of Poland. See, and this, you know who writes this? Norman Davies. I came upon him before, a couple of years ago, or maybe less, but he turns out to be a journalist who is, I don't know, if, I think his wife was Polish, that was it. His wife was Polish, and he became very, very friendly with Poles, and he did all kinds of writing, in the end writing some books that made the Poles look really good, just the way they wanted to look. And he went along with that, and that's pretty well established as far as I'm concerned. And a lot of the footnotes here are from him. In fact, he's got zillions of this page is Polish history, something like Polish history at the the history of Poland on Wikipedia. It's a very long page. Lots of stuff in it, and tons of stuff from Norman Davies and another person, wherever he went. I will come up to him, another Polish writer. But, you know, this Boleslaw wasn't a king of Poland. There wasn't any Poland. He wasn't the first king. There was another person later on who became the first king, supposedly. But they, so again, it was under the church rule, and these people were just working with the church or cooperating and baptizing people and trying to get people together as a, you know, to stick together as a tribe, as a group, as some kind of a, you know, territory, whatever. So, but in 997, Boleslaw's missionary, whose name was Adalbert of Prague. See, now Adalbert of Prague would be a German. And they were all mixed in with the Germans there. The Germans were absolutely there. And they were far advanced from what these people that we're talking about were, these supposedly Slavic people, if a lot of them weren't Germanized. But he was... But he got this German to be go on a mission for him. See, and this is what Germans will do. They're always cooperating and helping out. And this Adalbert was killed in Prussia on this mission, I guess. And as a result, there was a Congress of Gniezno in the year 1000. And Otto III, Holy Roman Emperor, authorized the founding of the Archbishopric of this Gniezno place, Gniezno, whatever it was. So we see that the Holy Roman Empire is established. The Roman Empire disintegrated, and the Germans took over, creating the Holy Roman Empire with the church, with the Pope and so on. And Otto III, a German, was the emperor of that. So again, you know, this is not just an empty place here with a bunch of Slavs becoming Polish. This was a place that was where Germans were in charge and in control, and the church was there, but they were trying to baptize a lot of people, and this Mieszko and then his son Boleslaw were helping with it, and this is what is, you know, supposed to be the beginning of the Polish nation. You see how questionable it is. Then I'm going to move pretty fast through here. Then there was the Piast monarchy was restored after some kind of wars that they had with Germany. And somebody had with Germany. And then Poland's, they keep calling it Poland even though it's not Poland. There's no Poland, but they keep using that word for what they want to say, because they want to call this Polish history. There's Casimir I brought about a restoration, and then his son was named Boleslaw II the Bold, and he became fatally involved in a conflict with Bishop Stanislaus of Sempinol and had him executed in 1079 and was expelled from the country. Now, you've got these so-called Polish names, like Stanislaus of Sempinol, in the, you know, in the year, in the 11th century. But were these names given later? Because there was no Polish language at this time, really. So you can't say that what they were speaking. The language kind of developed over a period of time. It had to. Because whatever they were originally speaking, they all had to learn the same language, which was a kind of a Polish language. So in 1295, one of the last ones, Przemyśl the second, managed to be crowned king of Poland, and he ruled over a limited territory and was soon killed. Now he managed to be crowned, but as it says, king of Poland. Who called it Poland? There was no Poland. Whatever was there, they're now calling it that. Whatever he was crowned king of. So then in 1300 to 1305, a Czech ruler, Vaclav II, also became king of Poland, and the Piast kingdom was restored under Władysław. That's a well-known Polish name. Władysław I, the elbow high, and who was crowned in 1320. So now they're being crowned. And in 1308, the Teutonic Knights seized Gdansk. That's, you know, up what became, what is actually Danzig. You see on this page, see on this Polish page, giving Polish history, it's talking about 1308. And they're calling this Danzig city by their current modern Polish name Gdansk, you see? That's the kind of thing that Poles do. They absolutely, almost more than anybody else, except maybe the Jews, want to make sure that their language is the one that's used all the time, as much as possible. And the western provinces of Silesia were formerly ceded by Casimir in 1339. Ceded by him, given over to, and he also lost Pomerania after the fragmentation. So they were not pulling anything together. They were some people were trying and then losing it and trying and losing it, and then some progress was made in the recovery of the central province of Mazovia. This is the Congress of Krakow took place in 1364. The same year that the future Jagiellonian University, which was basically German too, but was founded. And that's probably where the whole thing started going, with that the Jagiello people lineage and what they did. They were really more true leaders and rulers, and that's when the whole thing started taking shape. But they were from the north. They weren't Polish, this ruling family, this Jagiellonian, and I stopped here because I just knew I didn't have time to go on with all that. And look at, I've used up the first hour already just in this little beginning. But I thought that this part was very important to show how hazy the history is. And, of course, the Poles want to say they have a 1,000-year history. Their actual nation is 1,000 years old. Well, that goes back to the year 1000, you know, the 10th century to the 10th century to the 20th century, and they didn't have a nation all that time, and off and on. They didn't have these great nations that they claimed that they had. So let's see, where was I? Now I'm going to go to the new Polish language, and I'm back to Elsa Loser. She wrote, the new Polish language, puts Polish in quotes, was only invented much later and could hardly be imposed by force in the same way that the religion was. He said they were imposing the Catholic religion on these pagans by force, in a sense. But they couldn't force the language that way, since nobody would have understood it. So the transformation of an entire people into a previously non-existent ethnic group could hardly occur overnight. long periods of time were required for this purpose, as well as stubborn, deliberately conscious work. Now, this is her thesis, and she has a lot to back it up. But, of course, other people wouldn't agree with it, and the Polish academics and so on don't agree with this, I don't suppose. But this is her thesis. And she says, the first thing to be effaced was human memory, relegated to oblivion. The rewriting of the Cloister Chronicles, dating back to the year 966, the time of the first Christian baptism in the area, was only completed at the expense of great time and effort. So she's saying they did a lot of rewriting of things in order to create this thousand-year history. And it was, after all, necessary to take the name of every well-known person, every village, every ordinary object, and give it a new name, while concealing one's objective. Artificial languages, she says, are not as difficult to devise or as unusual as one might at first imagine, and synthetic languages can be created. Well, she says that the Polish language was invented by people around that time, and as they were trying to create the, and I think that she sees the Catholic Church behind the whole thing, and it makes sense because the Catholic Church was very powerful then, and they were trying to convert all the people, and so they were trying to make a group of people, and here you had a group of willing, apparently somewhat obedient, and you know not too rebellious type of people, the people that became the Poles, who they were working with, and turning into a nation that would have an identity as Polish. And this is a bit vague. I don't have anything much more to say about it, but the whole business is vague. The academic side of it is vague, too. I just have a translator's note here saying that the 1911 encyclopedia, Polish encyclopedia, remarks, the first press from which books in the Polish language appeared was that of Hieronymus Witor, a Silesian who commenced publishing in 1515. The first complete work in the Polish language appeared from the press of this printer at Krakow in 1521. We've got to remember always that Krakow was absolutely a German town, filled with Germans, speaking German and so on. And, of course, the printing press was invented by Gutenberg in around 1500, like something like that. And so the first press which printed anything in Polish, the first time anything in Polish was printed, was in Krakow by this German who had a printing press. Let's see, it says, talks here about what was printed. I don't think, the whole point of this, I don't need to read all this, but they're all Germans. Only Germans had printing presses, and only Germans were printers, and it gives some names, they're all German names. And they're mostly in Krakow. And then finally, in 1707, the first printing shop opened in Warsaw, and it was owned by the Piarists, that same Catholic teaching order. And there wasn't much Polish literature either. Supposedly, they used these Slavic songs and things to make out that this was early Polish literature. But there wasn't any until... they say it's all perished. What they say is that it didn't survive what there was, because there isn't any, all right, basically. And it says, within the Polish literary tradition, it is customary to include works that have dealt with Poland, even if not written by ethnic Poles. This is from Wikipedia, too. So this is accepted that Polish literary tradition includes, because I suppose it has to, works that others talk about Poland, even though they're not written by Poles. And... Elsa Loser says, Polish belongs to the West Slavonic group of languages, several of which acquired written form, with many German loan words, only in the 19th century. So Polish history is late in actually coming together, suggesting that it could have been, you know, basically invented later on. And the Polish writing is very late in showing up, and there weren't any early writers. And the Polish language didn't really get itself together until fairly late also. So there's there's a lot more here. I'll say, she says, Elsa Loser says, the manner in which Germans are transformed into Poles, she goes on talking about some of this stuff, and then she says that Germans were transformed into Poles. This is basically another part of her thesis. It's described very exactly in the Oster, she gives the pages of the East Germanian by Franz Wolff. And she says, I know from personal experience how German names became Polish, how German names were changed in the 1920s and 30s, how personal identity documents were issued bearing Polish names only. Thus, Elsa became, this is how they did it in the 20s and 30s, and they did absolutely kind of force people to, if they wanted to get their identity documents, if they wanted to get them, they had to use Polish first names. They couldn't make them use Polish last names, but they did want them to use Polish first names. And, of course, the Poles were trying to get everybody to speak Polish, to think Polish, and to become Polish, to actually, you know, identify as Polish. And that, so there, it's not just the Germans who wanted to Germanize Polish people and other people, but especially they're accused of wanting to Germanize the Polish people. But before that, the Polish people were really brutally trying to Germanize, trying to Polonize the German people, and also the Ukrainians and the Czechs and the White Russians and all the others who were in there in that Republic of Poland that was formed after World War I, which I'm going to go into in this next hour. But I still want to say here that, you know, she gives these different German names and how they became Polish names, like Elsa became Elspieta and Eugen became Eugenius, or however that Polish form is, and Albert or Albrecht became Wojciech, and Nikolaus became Mikolaj, and so on and so forth. Okay, that's it. I'm gonna play a short song to take a little break here, ladies and gentlemen, for you. Remember that I will be back, and I will take callers if you feel like you want to add something to the program, to what I've said so far. And the call-in number is 323-642-1206. But don't call in while the music is playing. Wait until we get back from this. And I think I'll play, let's see. I should have picked something out already. Oh, I've got some funny folk music that I got recorded, and I've never really played it. I'm going to play this short one that's only 2 minutes and 24 seconds. It seems like it's more like popular music, but I'm going to play it for the break. right. I hope you enjoyed that. This is Carolyn Yeager back again with the Heretics Hour on Monday, October 27, 2014. And we're now in the second hour. And we're in modern times, at least the period of the after the First World War and after the Treaty of Versailles, which awarded a lot of land to Poland and allowed it to become a republic for the first time in, well, it hadn't even been a country up to that time, but it's a nation, but it had been at times in the past. And I didn't even get into the Lithuanian Polish big nation that existed for a while. It was a joint endeavor, although I think it was the Poles who joined the Lithuanians. But in any event, there's all that. But it's that's more modern history, and so it's understood and better and actually more historical. But now we're in now Poland has gotten pretty much what it wanted from the Treaty of Versailles. For what reason is unknown, because they didn't win anything themselves. They just were on the winning side. So this is now from Bertrand de Colonna's book. I think this, I don't know if this, what part this is from. I just stuck it in here. But his book, Inside Poland, 1939, and he's writing in 1939 that he says there were actually some 2,500,000 Germans in the former German provinces awarded to Poland, but a big percentage left. A few, no doubt, did so of their own free will rather than become Polish citizens, but the majority left because they were subjected to petty annoyances in some cases and actual persecution in others. Their land was taken in the manner already described. Well, we haven't described it yet, but we will. Many of their schools were closed, their organizations were declared illegal, and they were debarred from working in many walks of life. Official positions were practically impossible to attain. Often enough, it was considered an offense for Germans to chat in the streets in their own language. I gave special attention to this point in Katowice, which is mainly German to this day. Walking quickly through the streets, I heard Polish being spoken here and there, but not a sound of German reached my ears. I then strolled slowly along, listening attentively, and I heard German being spoken in undertones. Whilst the Poles chatted loudly, the Germans spoke in undertones. I approached a group of four people talking German quietly, and their conversation ceased. Again, on one of the squares where there are many seats, I sat down, and the conversation ceased. One young couple exchanged a few words of broken Polish. I turned to three young men on the other side of my seat and asked them in German the name of the square, adding that I was English. Smiles of relief were noticeable, nods exchanged, and low voices began talking German again. My new friends explained that talking German led to trouble. They would be asked questions, perhaps even arrested. One of them had a German novel, absolutely non-political, with him, but it was in a Polish paper cover so that no one might notice he was reading German. In 1938, there were 107 German periodicals published in Poland, and the number is still round about 100, all of which sell reasonably well, but one seldom sees people reading them unless it is in their own homes. Now, his book is divided into sections, and this they have titles, and this section is Dreams of Empire. If you go to DanzigFreeState.org, you will find toward the bottom of the page the book that I'm speaking of. And I can move all the way down here. I've got a link to it here. Here it is. I think I'll put it up and take down something else that I don't need. Now, this comes up again and again, but what the treaty, what happened, what Poland was given was other people's land, or the land that it was claiming for itself, and then other parts of German territory, parts of Ukrainian territory. That was the largest. There were more Ukrainians in this new Republic of Poland than any other minority. And there were Czechs, and there were a lot of white Russians, Slovaks there, and they had all been in their own land, and their land had been ceded or given over to make this Polish Republic, and Poland was, of course, the majority, and so it ruled, and it was supposed to, it had never ruled over other people before, but it was supposed to run this, what was called a state with a lot of major minorities in it, and make it all work out. It was stupid. It was absolutely, you know, the dumbest thing in the world. And, of course, the Poles didn't do what they were supposed to do, and these other groups suffered so much for so long until they could get the attention of countries like Britain and, well, France didn't ever care. France was always supporting Poland and the League of Nations and so on. But they, you know, nobody acted. Finally, the English started to make comments in the House of Commons and so on. And, you know, disapproving of what the Poles were doing and even saying it was outrageous, but they didn't take any action. So finally, Adolf Hitler took action in protection of the Germans, and then they took action against the English, were ready to take action against Hitler for doing something about it. So this is where it all comes from. So I'm going to start now because some of it, what this man Bertram de Colonna writes is so good, and he sounds very sincere, honest, and truthful in what he says, the way he writes it, and I believe that he is. So I will continue here under the chapter, if you want to call it, Dreams of Empire, talking about it's important in describing the Polish thought process, or the Polish, what I call the Polish personality. He says, the Poles say that they are the outposts of Europe and once saved civilization from Asiatic hordes. Now, in their own Polish areas, the Poles did build up a state, which was good in many respects, but which failed to survive as a result of internal strife. The nobles constantly fought against each other and did not unite until they found themselves under the domination of Tsarist Russia. The Russians treated the Poles badly, and it was a good thing when the Poles regained their independence. Unluckily for all concerned, however, the Poles were also given non-Polish districts, and they, in their turn, have ruled over their own minorities badly. History should have taught us better, for the Ukrainians had once before lived under Polish rule, and it was then that the Asiatic hordes under Genghis Khan were first defeated. Only there is a slight error here. It was the Ukrainian people and their volunteer guards, the Cossacks, who saved Europe from the Mongols, and not the Poles. As, however, Poland claimed sovereignty over Ukraine at the time, many Poles do, no doubt, genuinely believe it was their ancestors who fought, but that is a mistake. The Ukraine was formerly known as the Grand Duchy of Kiev and was the first Slav country to make its mark in history, not the Poles. In the 11th and 12th centuries, Kiev was at the height of its power, but later internal strife and dynastic quarrels weakened the nation. As a result, Genghis Khan, he writes it Genghis Khan, and his hordes found them an easy prey, or at least a comparatively easy one. The Ukrainians made an effort to unite and resisted the attack made at the beginning of the 13th century. In 1224, the army of the Grand Duchy of Kiev was routed, but guerrilla warfare continued with such desperation that it was not until 16 years later that the Asiatics succeeded in capturing and destroying the capital. They have never been entirely independent since, but have never lost their dream of independence. They are mainly to be found in Russia, while some are included in Romania, but they also form Poland's greatest minority. Their language is distinct from all others. he seems to have a good opinion of the Ukrainians, and because of that, he's given me a good opinion too. He and taught me some things I had not known. I have now I went to Wikipedia again and looked up the Mongol invasion of Europe, and got some corroboration of this. It says the traditional European method of warfare of melee combat between knights ended in catastrophe when it was deployed against the Mongol forces, as the Mongols were able to keep a distance and advance with superior number. The new Encyclopedia Britannica, volume 29, says that employed against the Mongol invaders of Europe, knightly warfare failed even more disastrously for the Poles at Legnica and the Hungarians at Mohi in 1241. Feudal Europe was saved from sharing the fate of China and Muscovy, not by its tactical prowess, but by the unexpected death of the Mongol supreme ruler, gives his name, and the subsequent eastern retreat of his armies. The Mongols destroyed an army of Germans, French, and Poles, numbering 30,000 at the Battle of Legnica, and slaughtering nearly 25,000. After that, the German cities quickly capitulated. And then, against Poland, in 1259 and 1287, we've gone up to that date, in 1259, 18 years after the first attack, two Tumans, which is 20,000 men each, from the Golden Horde, under the leadership of Berka, attacked Poland after raiding Lithuania. This attack was commanded by General Burundi and with two young princes, and Lublin, Sieradz, Sandomierz, Zawichos, Krakow, and Bytom, mostly Polish names there, were ravaged and plundered. Berka had no intention of occupying or conquering Poland. This was the Mongol leader. After this raid, the Pope Alexander IV tried without success to organize a crusade against the Tatars. Then the third Mongol invasion of Poland was an unsuccessful raid followed in 1287, led by Talabuga and Nogai Khan. Lublin and these other cities were successfully raided, but they were defeated at Krakow, or I guess the Mongols were defeated at Krakow. Although this city was devastated anyway, this raid consisted of less than one Tumen, since the Golden Horde's armies were tied down in a new conflict, which the Ilkhanate initiated in 1284. The force sent was not sufficient to meet the full Polish army, nor did it have any siege engineers or equipment to breach city walls. It raided a few caravans, burned a few small towns, and fled when the Polish army was mustered. I don't know if I should have bothered reading that, but now we're going back to Poland from the inside. That's the name of the book, not Inside Poland. Poland from the Inside, and a little bit from the chapter Historical Survey. De Colonna writes, all the Polish, and he puts Polish in quotes, all the Polish rulers bore the title of Duke. This is his view of the history. And during their rule, the sovereignty of the German Empire was repeatedly acknowledged. So, see, they were not kings. They were dukes under the German Empire is what they were. But the Poles want to say they were independent kings and they had an independent nation and so on. Now, he says, it was not until the 14th century that a king was crowned and a certain amount of law and order established in place of the struggles between the rival ducal factions. Poland was united with Hungary, but this was purely a personal union under King Louis, which ceased on his death. See, a lot of these things that happened, they were just, they didn't have any lasting value. So it said, peace was not, however, to last long. The nobles repeatedly tried to overawe the people, and there was later a war with Sweden. In the second half of the 17th century, civil war broke out. Domestic strife actually survived two partitions. Remember these famous partitions of Poland. The second in 1793, when most of the formerly Polish territory went to Russia, with a population of 3 million Poles, while Prussia received a strip with 1,100,000 inhabitants. Kosciuszko tried, a Polish leader, tried in 1794 to unite the Poles. 1794! And many poems tell of his prowess. But shortly afterwards, he was defeated at Praga, not to be confused with Prague in Bohemia, and a third partition took place, Russia, Prussia, and Austria obtaining the territory. Russia again took over the largest part. During the Napoleonic Wars, the Poles established a kind of independence following the Peace of Tilsit. The Peace of Vienna added to this Polish state, and hopes were placed in Napoleon by many Poles, but they were doomed to disappointment. All the French wished for in Poland was to raise an army to help defeat Russia. In 1812, the new state, known as the Duchy of Warsaw, came to a sudden collapse. In 1815, the Poles were promised a certain representation with two chambers by Tsar Alexander I. They are always looking for favors. The first parliament did meet, it is true, but it had no real power, and things became still worse when Alexander died. In 1830, the Poles revolted and drove the Russians across the borders. The Polish nobility took over the reins of government, but party strife prevented any real work of reconstruction. The nobles and people could not agree, and the way was thus paved for the return of the Russians. Klopicki must be Polish, established himself as dictator and tried to negotiate with Russia with the object of keeping the Polish people from overruling the nobility, but the Russians demanded complete capitulation. Had the Poles remained united, they could have maintained their full independence, but when one party endeavored to make terms with Russia at the expense of the other, Poland lost her liberty. See, that's a trait where they will try to, there's a lack of honor there, and where they won't, they'll take advantage of their own people to try to get some advantage for themselves, or they'll give up their own people to get some advantage for themselves, and that's what happened here between these two, between different groups. Poland lost her liberty then. Marshal Diebitsch assembled an army of 120,000 men and advanced on Warsaw. After brave resistance, the Poles were defeated and their leader sought refuge in Austria. It is interesting to note that in 1831, just over a century ago, the Poles appealed for aid in London and Paris, but met with little sympathy. So, in 1831, all right, you know, 100 years before the current time, the Poles were trying to get help from London and Paris, but didn't get any, but yet they still always clung to the idea that London and Paris were their saviors. That's who they wanted to be associated with. Probably thought they were the strongest. Most of those, and of course they wouldn't turn to Russia, so they needed to find someone, and they wouldn't turn to the Germans, so that left London and Paris. Most of those known to have played a leading part in the revolt were sent to Siberia. Well, this is how badly they were treated then by the Russians. And I'm going to move on down to past two paragraphs here. There might be some interesting stuff there, but anyway, I'm going to move here and say one insurrection followed the other in Russian Poland. Poland was now part of Russia. In 1867, the Tsar even went so far as to refuse the Polish clergy all contact with Rome, oh, horrors, and the property of Poles was confiscated. There was little improvement when the present century dawned, and a bitter hatred of the Russians prevails in Poland to this day. For after the Bolshevik Revolution, the new Moscow authorities showed no change of attitude. So the Bolsheviks they tried to think maybe the Bolsheviks would treat them better, would work better with them, but they were no different than the Tsars. Now, the Poles and Germans, it says, lived in parts of Prussia on fairly good terms in more recent years preceding the war. while he's talking now about maybe he means preceding the first war. Has to be, because he doesn't know anything about the second war. It's the summer of 1939, and he has no idea that there's going to be a big war. So he's talking about the first war, preceding the First World War. Poles and Germans lived in Prussia on fairly good terms. So it goes on to say conditions improved as a result of Germany's industrial expansion, which assured ample opportunities for all. Many Poles were more than satisfied, and when the Great War came, they fought solidly with the Germans and Austrians, while those compelled to serve with the Russian army deserted at the first opportunity. There were, however, exceptions, and some Poles dreamed of an empire stretching to Berlin and Stettin. So, you know, this seems to be saying that while a lot of Poles felt just fine about the Germans and Austrians, and they hated the Russians so much, so they were fighting with them against the Russians, but there are some of those who still couldn't get over the idea that they wanted more. They wanted to have this big empire that stretched to Berlin. Indeed, he writes, one side of the river Havel, which almost skirts Berlin, was repeatedly quoted in Polish. The war did not fulfill their dreams, the First War. It brought them areas containing many non-Poles, but not yet the vast empire they had hoped for. Lithuania was also to be included. So they got part of Lithuania too, that's right. And as a matter of fact, the Vilna district was taken from the Lithuanians by the Poles in defiance to the Allies. You know, along with what they were given by the Allies in the treaty, they took even, if they could, they took even more, and they did take more of Lithuania, the Vilna district. The most recent addition to the Polish Republic is Chechen, which is Czech, means Czech, where the Czechs live, which was Warsaw's share in the partition of Czechoslovakia. Its cession to Poland resulted in new dreams of empire because they got part of Czechoslovakia. And that map that I used on the program announcement, and I'll use it for the program post, shows all of that, what I've just read. The population of Poland after the Versailles Treaty is, in 1939, not right after the treaty, but in 1939, when he's writing, the population of Poland is 34,900,000, excluding foreign residents. But one must not assume that there are as many Poles as that in that country. The inhabitants are made up of 7 million Ukrainians, 2 million White Russians, 3.2 million Jews, 1.5 million Germans. There used to be 2.5 million Germans, but a million of them left by now, by 1939. They had left. They couldn't take it. They left their goods behind, too, their businesses and their homes. And 200,000 Lithuanians. So they were the smallest group. Ukrainians by far the largest. And that left only 21 million Poles in the country. But they dominate, so it may be safely assumed that many non-Poles record their national group as Polish in order to avoid difficulties. So there might be even bigger minorities than that. A lot of these minorities have decided to just go ahead and become Polish. One might perhaps put the number of Poles at 20 million without fear of underestimating. He writes about the Jews, saying that Warsaw quotes them in this category of a minority. They're considered a minority along with the others, rather than just a part of Poland or something. And I remember that the first official step towards the reestablishment of a new Polish state. Oh yeah, we need to remember that the first official step toward the reestablishment of a new Polish state was taken by Germany, a fact often forgotten. In 1916, Germany proclaimed Polish independence. on its own, you know, helping the Poles out. And Pilsudski made a pact with the Reich before the war came to an end in the World War I. But, of course, Berlin had not intended to add such areas as Upper Silesia in the corridor to Poland, and the corridor to Poland when they helped establish this new Polish state. And this shows, the ingratitude of the Polish leaders and of the Poles in not appreciating what the Germans did for them and then wanting to just grab more of what was Germany. The Jewish minority, it says, of 3,200,000 is confessional, that is, that those who admit to being Jews. And they said it must be at least another 500,000 Jews who have become Christians, and yet those who confess to being Jews make up 10% of the entire population. Okay, the bare figure does not convey the full significance of this group of Jews. 70% of Jews reside in the towns, particularly of central, east, and south Poland. In Warsaw, for example, there are 820,000 Christians and over 350,000 Jews. Wow, think of that proportion. And the baptized Jews being included among the Christians. So there's even more Jews there than that. But so there's what? Close to a third Jews? That's more than that. Two-thirds Christians? More than that. Getting closer to a half. But not at a half. All right, we're going now to chapter 6, On Tour in Poland. This is really interesting. Krakow was once the capital of Poland and is the oldest and most beautiful city in the country. Most of the people know German, and there are several big minorities. One can accost any passerby in German, and the chances are 10 to 1 that he answers in the same language. Now, remember again, this is in 1939. When I went to the official Polish tourist bureau at Krakow, I found no one spoke a single word of English or German, and only one girl knew French. A guide speaking any one of these languages could not, I was told, regretfully, be obtained. Oh, somebody's here. I'm sorry, I just now saw your call.
Yeah, hi, Caroline. This is Marcus. How are you doing?
Hi, Marcus. Thanks for calling.
All right, you're welcome. How are you?
I'm fine. Have you been able to listen to the whole show so far?
Yeah, but I listened to most of it, yes.
Okay, did you have a specific comment on it you wanted to make at this point, or were you just listening?
No, I have a few comments on what you said so far. It's about 5 or 6 points. Let me just read them. So the French is an invented language as well, where Gaelic and Francian, which is a German language, used to be spoken. Then the East Germanic languages are now extinct, and they used to be spoken in the area which is Poland now, more or less. Then Mussolini ordered the South Tyrolean Germans to take Italian names as well. So that's not only in Poland or elsewhere. And the Duchy of Kiev was basically the birthplace of Russia and was founded by Swedes, possibly Gothic, East Germanic people. Two more, I think. Memeland was taken by Lithuania. It was like Danzig, a free state. And they just took it.
When did they do that?
Oh, this I believe in the 1920s. And then Hitler took it back, but he granted them 100-year special rights in the Memeland to make commerce and so forth. So that's how he managed to get it back peacefully without much struggle there.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one is interesting. Russia is not part of the Treaty of Versailles. So yet most of Poland was carved out of Russia and the USSR. So I don't know. Maybe that's just something to think about.
Well, Poland, after the Versailles Treaty, was carved out of Russia? Are you saying?
A lot of it...
It was already Russian. Poland didn't exist at that time. So it was created after the Versailles Treaty, or at the Versailles Treaty.
That's right, but Russia was not part of the Versailles Treaty.
No, right, I get that. So I guess, but Russia had turned Bolshevik, and they had dropped out of the war. So they were not caring. So the West just put that together, and they just went along with it, didn't they? They didn't argue about it.
I don't know, because Poland and the USSR, they had a war in the 1920s. Maybe they weren't so happy about it after all, but they couldn't do much about it, I think.
You know, I never thought about that war in connection with it being against the Bolshevik Russia. I never did. So that makes it kind of interesting. We'll have to look into that sometime.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. I don't have too much information on that either. I just thought about it. And then one last point. Poland took part of the Czechoslovakia when Germany managed to get treaties to get the Sudetenland back and establish a protectorate. And the independent state of Slovakia. But Poland went in there by force and took a little part of Czech Silesia without a treaty. So that's another thing I wanted to mention.
Well, you know, Poland, turns out, once they got their state, once they got their territory and they got their new republic, they turned out to be very aggressive and not very nice people, you know, and they went after everything and everyone they could. And I haven't gotten to the worst of it yet. You know, isn't it interesting, though, that in Poland, the way they treated the minorities right off the bat, I mean, you know, they were supposed to treat them well and allow them to have what was called self-determination, which was the big thing about World War One, you know, that all these countries were deserved to have their self-determination, and all these minorities were supposed to be able to have their language and their schools and, you know, be left alone. But they didn't do that at all. And nobody helped them for the longest time. Well, I think I already covered that. So what I'm going over now is that... in this city of Krakow, he's there in 1939, and he notices that all these people do speak German. It's still a German-speaking city, but when he goes into the official Polish, tour guide place and tries to get an English-speaking guide to take him on a tour of the city, they don't have one, and they don't have one in any language, only Polish. And then he says that, my belief was later confirmed. He didn't think this was because they couldn't find any, but he thought it was on purpose. And he said, my belief was later confirmed at Katowice, another German city in Poland, where I went into the Polish Travel Bureau, and no one, even after I showed my passport, was prepared to speak anything but Polish. While in the street, more people understood German than Polish. So he says, this is saying a lot about what they're doing. I've got a story about my own short time in Poland, but I don't think I'll bother with that now because I don't want to get. I would like to try to complete a lot of this that I have here. You know, then they're talking about Gdynia, that port city, or he is, that, you know, that they built this port up there on the coast next to Danzig, Herr Danzig was disputed, had been disputed, and so then the Poles, Danzig was considered the free state, but under they had some kind of control over it. Customs, they were in charge of the customs office there in Danzig for the port, and which was pretty busy. But they built another port there, and they called it, I don't know how you pronounce it, but Gdynia, Gdynia, for themselves. And it was unnecessary to do it, he says, but they thought that the customs union would cease to exist sooner or later, and so they built this other port for themselves, and because they didn't actually own the Danzig state. Gdynia's population started out with 2,000 Germans, and in several years' time, it grew to 110,000 people from 2,100. They were all Polish, so the Poles put all their Polish people there and made it a Polish town, and it looks like a modern Polish city. And pretty soon, the 2,000 Germans were gone. So, but he says that the corridor was still predominantly German, even with all the work they did to try to make it, to try to move Poles in there. And they did move a lot of Poles into the corridor area, which was that area that they were given that divided Germany from its East German province, and, which was stupid, absolutely stupid to begin with. And then, but even though they kept trying to move Poles in there, it still remained a predominantly German area.
For Gdynia was to compete with Danzig, so that Danzig
right.
Becomes a, you know, a lot of unemployment and people move away and so forth. They wanted to cut Danzig off as this most important port in the Baltic area, and then once it's basically, you know, lots of unemployment and so on, it's easier to take over. That's what I believe was the reason.
Well, yeah, and they were doing that, and they were they did take all kinds of business away from Danzig. Danzig became, you know, where it was the main port, and then the other one became the main port. But then they still wanted Danzig. You see, as you just said, then if they did that so they could take it over more easily. It's kind of interesting that they didn't need it. They didn't need Danzig for a port. And then this author talks in some parts, I don't think I'm even planning on reading that, but he describes how the Poles never had access to the sea, and they weren't seamen, and they never did have much of a navy, very little, and they never used the sea, and they didn't even do much of anything. It was mostly recreational. They didn't have that much going on there. You know, but they want this, what I'm trying to say about the Polish nature, they want everything, even though they can't make use of it. You know, whether they can make use of it or not, they don't care. They just know that they want it. So I'm trying to show this the way it really is, and I'm not going to try to be nice and, well, let's all be kind to one another, because as we go on, some of the things I want to make sure I read what they, you know, what they, the really terrible things they did to these minorities. It just got worse and worse. They also, and they didn't treat tourists well, and they didn't have very many tourists. This guy says there was hardly anybody there, you know, in 1939, because they're so unfriendly, and they make people pay for a visa and tax them daily. And here's an interesting story. It says that motorists are taxed 1 zloty per day for the upkeep of the roads every day. And he says, I met a Scotsman and his wife in Warsaw, and their car had suffered considerably, they told me, owing to the bad state of the roads. Between Gdynia, that port, and Warsaw, and around Plock, they assured me the roads were among the worst they had ever seen in their lives. Okay, well, let's go on to treatment of minorities. I'll try to just paraphrase some of this. So, though they knew when they created this Polish state, that there was probably going to be disputes and so on between the Poles and their minorities, but they didn't expect them to reach to have such consequences as what proved to be the case. And they thought that these people would be able to work it out, but the Poles were the ones who were completely and totally determined to have everything their way. And it says, at the beginning in 1919, the Danzigers demanded union with the Reich. Well, this is the whole story about Danzig. I think I'll skip that because we've talked about that before. Here, the need of more Ukrainian and German schools. You know, what are you doing? You're moving things around or something.
So
I know every little thing makes a lot of noise.
Oh, I
know that. So. Okay. If you want to, now, if you want to break in anywhere, do, because you always have something interesting to say, Marcus. But
okay,
here we're
going to
talk about the schools. The need of more Ukrainian and German schools is beyond dispute, he's writing in 1939, yet the authorities are doing their best to reduce the already meager total. All this is in direct opposition to the terms under which Poland was given the minority areas. The Poles persuaded the Allies that they would care for all of their minorities, and their word was accepted. It has turned out that this was a mistake. In point of fact, it requires a brave man to send his son or daughter to a non-Polish school. He is, moreover, probably exposing his child to difficulties in later life. The Poles have finally calculated this factor, and it has been fairly successful in achieving its purpose. And then it talks about the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians remained in their native areas, so, you know, they're in their area where they were, like the Germans in Silesia, and they were just added to the Polish state. Said so. So far as they were not imprisoned or sent to Warsaw under protest, but the Germans who decided to retain their Reich nationality knew when they did so that they would have to pay, that they would have to leave hearth and home. They automatically became foreigners in their own country. Nothing can be said against this. The persons concerned is that you can't speak about this in Poland. The people who voted for German nationality, fully knowing what would result, it was hard on them to have to choose between their homes and the true country of course, but he says, but the worst part came afterwards when the Poles informed numerous German-speaking landowners that they were not Polish citizens and could not therefore continue to be farmers in the Republic. They were trying to take all their farms and all their property from them. And he says small holders were less affected, but big German landowners suffered severely. In many cases, the fact that a son had studied at a university in Prussia was regarded as rendering the whole family ineligible for Polish nationality, and it must be remembered that the areas where the farmers lived had been a part of Prussia until 1919. At the beginning of August 1923, the police raided the branches of this Bund that the Germans had formed to, you know, it was called the Deutschlandsbund. Within 3 days, not a single branch was left. They raided all the branches of this this league that the Germans belonged to in different places. And the Polish press reported that the organization had been aiming at high treason. None of its leaders was brought up for trial, though. They just got rid of the organization, and that was it. Nevertheless, the Polish action achieved its purpose to get rid of that organization, all right. And the Germans, whose property was seized, received compensation, it is true, but the amounts were ridiculously small. Oh, now it says that if they found that you were had done something wrong, they seized your property, but the amounts that they paid you for it were ridiculously small. For example, Baron Ferick's property at Radolin, known to be worth several million gold zloty, was officially valued at only 250,000 gold zloty. And the big Henderson estates at Lissa had been officially estimated at $451,000, but the official valuation when it came to expropriation was $40,000. And I quote these two examples because the estates were fairly well known, but less famous property fared no better. The extent of the appropriation may be seen from the statement of the Polish Liquidation Commission on May 27, 1929, that 4,000 country estates and 2,000 plots of land in municipal areas had been liquidated. 4,000 estates owned by Germans and 2,000 plots of land in municipal areas, in cities, had been liquidated. That is, they take them over and they pay the people something, but not nearly what it's worth. And then they talk, you know, Marcus, about this, how the Germans stole all this stuff from the Jews, you know, and by buying it cheap, by somehow causing prices to fall and then buying it all up. You know, actually, they weren't doing that. Prices were falling, and some things were going on sale because Jews were leaving. But look at here what the Poles were doing to the Germans before that ever happened, long before. They were doing the same thing. They were actually doing it. They were causing their property to have far less value and taking it over, buying them out. That's another Jewish tactic, by the way. I know that. That's what they do during booms and during busts, when they bring the prices down and everything and then buy it all out. That's what they were doing in Germany, too, between the wars after World War I. Now, in the areas taken over by the Poles, failure to produce a document was regarded as a reason for driving the owners from the land. The fact that the applications had in many cases been pending for years was not taken into consideration. So, you know, these people couldn't get the documents that they needed, but they didn't, you know, the Poles didn't care. They said, well, you don't have the documents, so we have to take over your property. The Poles said they were the successors of the Prussians and must drive away all who had no documents to confirm ownership. That is, and precisely 3,964, say roughly 4,000 German settlers were robbed of their land in this way and became homeless. They received no compensation. And one method that they used to do this was as follows. The Prussian government had financially assisted many of the smallholders to buy land and possessed, until such time as the payments were completely returned, the right to buy the holders out. But of course they were fair-minded about it. Before the Treaty of Versailles came into effect, Prussia had transferred its claims to the German Peasants' Bank at Danzig. So Danzig, the Peasants' Bank was handling this. But Poland claimed to have taken over the right, along with sovereignty of the province of Danzig, or the province in question. He says he's not going to go into the rights and wrongs of the claims of the Danzig Bank and the Polish state. But what the point is that the Poles used this opportunity to dispossess the Germans forcibly. When a smallholder died, his lawful heirs were not allowed to take over his property, which was claimed by the Polish government as its own. This meant no compensation at all. The owner could sell during his lifetime, but only Poles were allowed to buy from him, and the price was kept down to an absurd level. So if he didn't want to sell to a Pole for an absurd price, when he died, his heirs were not allowed to take over the property, I think because they weren't Polish. That was some kind of law they passed or something they did, which really wasn't legal, but they did it. Hundreds of these cases were brought before the courts, often before international courts, but no redress was made until 1929, and even then it only affected those who had not been robbed of their land in the meanwhile. Now we're going to go into the chapter of the small nationalities, and I intend to read all of this because I think it's so important, and it's just faster if I just read it than if I try to pick and choose things from it, which I get confused. So I'm gonna do as I thought I told myself I should do. This will tell us a lot about how the Poles treated their minorities, some of the worst of it. But there are, on the other hand, many good reasons for intervening in the interests of small nationalities. Take the Ukrainians in Poland. I have referred in general to numerous acts of oppression throughout the centuries and propose now to quote some specific examples. Although the Ukrainians could vote, with a few exceptions, for the Sejm, that's the Polish parliament, S-E-J-M, Sejm, I don't know, they were prevented from sending many of their own representatives to parliament by the most ruthless measures. In summer 1930, when preparations were being made for the November elections, the anti-Ukrainian action began. For the Ukrainian faction was still the most powerful parliamentary minority movement. Well, right, there were 7 million Ukrainians. An excuse was easy to find, for there had been no peace in Polish Ukraine within living memory. At the end of August 1930, 50 Polish farms went up in flames and Ukrainians were blamed. Well, there you go. Now, this was a situation where somehow these farms went up, burned up, and they blamed the Ukrainians for doing it. Whether they did or not, I don't know, but this never says that they ever found out anything for sure. And, therefore, the prisons in the cities were not large enough to hold the Ukrainian parliamentarians, priests, teachers, students, and writers who were arrested. Crowds of prisoners arrived at the prison gates every day. Cells soon housed from 12 to 20 Ukrainians, although ordinarily never more than 5 at an absolute maximum were confined in them. Trial before the courts was omitted in thousands of cases. Here and there, the prisoners were simply shot out of hand, officially because they tried to escape. It says, remarkably enough, they were invariably killed and never wounded. Isn't that funny, too, because the Poles are so big in accusing the Germans of shooting people who tried to escape from a concentration camp or something. It's the same as a prison. And how wrong they are, and they're still trying to catch these people and prosecute them today. And yet they were doing it, and nothing ever happened to them, and nobody ever put them in trouble for it. That's just how shows how it's all just totally political. Now, a Ukrainian politician named Holowinski was shot in this way, supposedly trying to escape. But all this did not prevent the Ukrainians from voting. The Ukrainians still, the ones who were, you know, still free and not and so on, still went out and voted. And what the Polish didn't want was for these people to vote and send their members, their, you know, representatives to the parliament, to the Polish parliament. So Polish troops advanced against the villages at this time. And a troop of men from the 14th Polish Uhlan Regiment left Lemberg early in September, their objective being the village of Gaja. Like most villages in this part of the country, which was Galicia, Gaja was surrounded by trees. Nearing the village, they encountered peasants with their carts driving along the middle of the road. The peasants, surprised, made way for the cavalcade. That is, they got out of the middle of the road. But the peasants did not doff their caps on seeing the military force. One of the non-commissioned officers hit the foremost peasant in the face with a leather whip, leaving long blood-red wheels, or stripes, marks. The peasant fell from his seat into a ditch. Several other peasants speedily jumped down and two or three turned to the man in the ditch. Before they could reach him, Polish soldiers attacked them with whips. 10 minutes later, the troops continued their ride. The mounted men stopped in front of the house of the local mayor. They got to the village. Mayor and councilors had to appear and to hand over a list of inhabitants of the village. The village was sentenced to a community fine of 50 CWT period, cubic something, I don't know, of oats, 1,000 eggs, 20 pigs, 50 cubic weight of flour, and 50 cubic weight of a groat-like substance in common use in the Ukraine, some grain thing. Furthermore, the troops that were there were to be given a full load of food, cigarettes, spirit, and tobacco. The time limit was fixed at 2 hours. Now, Kelowna writes, Ukrainian villages are not rich as a rule, but they were told that if they did not bring the supplies within the 2 hours, the soldiers would forage for themselves, like in their homes, in barns and whatever. And those with pretty wives and daughters trembled at the idea of Polish soldiery in their homes. The supplies were collected, therefore, although it meant that the village would suffer bitter hardship afterward. Then the peasants were made to assemble. Their clothing was torn off, and each of them was held by four soldiers, while others beat them without mercy. When they lost consciousness, pails of water were thrown over them. After a time, they were flung into one corner of the communal room, and the next batch was similarly treated. Incidentally, the lieutenant in command left this work to his subordinates. Now, I need to insist once again that this man is not someone who would be writing this if he didn't believe it to be true. And he talks about that a little bit later on, too. But going on, he writes, this is a typical example. A typical example, though the process sometimes varied. In the village of Hristice, we're in the Ukrainian section, Lieutenant Newman called the counselors of the village. For 4 hours, they had to stand at attention and were beaten for the slightest movement. The mayor was asked who had arms, and on his replying that no one had any, he was given 50 blows on the naked body. The members of the council, whose names were Michael Lasserow, Alexander Lasserow, Wyszanski, three more Polish names, and then Burbel and Verez, were treated similarly. The authorities afterwards refused to receive the deputation from this village when protest was to have been made. That is, the village sent a group to protest what had happened, and the authorities did not receive them. This is pretty sickening. And, you know, they do this, they're doing this in order to frighten the people who keep voting. As we said earlier, in spite of what was going on, they continued to vote to send their representatives to the parliament, and polls didn't want them to do that. So they're doing this to them to scare them or treat them, you know, make them afraid and stop them, and they did have success with it, too. So it goes on. In the village of Jerisko, 20 peasants were whipped. In the village of Horodislavish, the whole Ukrainian library was destroyed, including religious works. Numerous villagers were also beaten up. In the village of Kuris, a peasant named Politaj, an old man, was beaten until he lost consciousness, then revived with pails of cold water, and forced to walk through the village barefooted. A Polish soldier rode on either side of him, a whip in his hand. In Maistowice, two women were also beaten until they were unconscious, but this outrage was perpetrated by the police and not by soldiers. These police had bound bands round their caps so that their numbers could not be recognized. It can be understood that the state of these and scores of other villages was ghastly after the troops retired. I have quoted the month in which all this was carried out in a wholesale manner, but cases enough have occurred at other times. This anti-Ukrainian action was successful. The Ukrainian faction in the Sejm was much smaller at the following election. In some areas, only the government candidates were proposed, none daring to nominate others. It is hard to produce documentary proof of this brutality, since in Poland there is no freedom of movement. Every foreigner has to register with the police through his hotel, and he has difficulties in seeing things for himself. He's speaking about himself as a foreigner. I did see much, but did not take my camera further than Krakow, as I had no wish to come into conflict with the authorities. To take a camera further into the southeast direction is tantamount to asking for arrest. Nobody troubled me in Krakow, but then the scenes of the outrages were all far away. In Lemberg, things are stricter, and any foreigner seen in Ukrainian villages is an immediate object of suspicion. I visited some villages and was unquestionably lucky to escape trouble. He writes, William Day of the Canadian Times visited the villages after the great work of destruction that he's talking about here, and he photographed a village where the troops had spent several days. He also took pictures of peasants who had been tortured or injured. Nothing happened to him there, and he returned to Lemberg to dispatch his report and pictures. He was immediately arrested, his camera, plates, and pictures seized, and he himself remained in a cell until the consul secured his release. He was then compelled to leave the country at once. The charge against him was, quote, spreading information dangerous to the state, unquote. The conditions in the prisons must be dreadful if the stories of the relations of Ukrainian prisoners are to be believed. But I did not see these prisons, so I can give no first-hand information. It is quite impossible to obtain permission to visit them. After these excesses, the opposition in the SEM asked pertinent questions and also demanded an investigation into conditions in Lugz prison. The Polish Minister of the Interior replied that he had made inquiries, but that everything seemed to him to be in order at Lugz. A short time afterwards, he actually informed Parliament that a prison officer had been punished there for stealing a gold watch from a prisoner. It is scarcely necessary to add that since 1930, the Ukrainians hate Warsaw. Well, you know, see, what this prison official thought, he better do something. So he said that he had punished an officer for stealing a gold watch from a prisoner instead of all the other stuff that the torture and abuse that needed to be investigated. Kelowna says, it is hard to believe all this, as I readily admit. Now, again, you know, it's not hard now, but in 1939, he's writing this, saying that people wouldn't think this was going on. He said, if I had not spoken with so many other persons concerned, I should not believe it myself. The Polish officials I had to deal with were the most polite men I have ever met. And he goes on to describe how helpful they were to him when he came into the country, and they didn't ask him any questions, and they allowed him to bring all his whatever money he had with him, and they gave him a receipt so that he could, if he had whatever he had left when his visit was over, he could take it back out again. He says, they did everything possible to make me feel at home. But you know what? And then he says, it's hard. I find it hard to explain that such kindly people are so brutal to their minorities. Such, however, is the simple fact. So he knows they're brutal to the minorities, but you know why they were so nice to him? Because he's a British visitor, and he probably has some connections. He was coming there in 1939 when there was all this trouble going on and all these negotiations and, you know, back and forth diplomatic things and so on. So they were told to treat him very, very well, and yet he still was the person who was there on a fact-finding mission, you might say, and he wanted to see everything, so he went to all these areas where he could see what was really going on. So a little more here, he says, white Russians, too, have told me dreadful things. In 1921, there were 514 white Russian schools in Poland. In 1925, 4 years later, there were only 20. The remaining 494 were closed, and in 1926 there were just 3 of these schools left. A kind of guerrilla warfare has been waged for 2 decades between white Russians and Poles. Isolated Polish settlers dare not go out unarmed, Even today, 20 years after the inclusion of the area in the Polish Republic, even 20 years later, they still, Polish settlers, can't go out unarmed. I don't know if he's talking about Polish people or the minority people, but at first the white Russians were inclined to turn Bolshevik in order to obtain Russia's help against the Poles. Later, they tried for independence. On January 15, 1927, the Polish police rounded up the white Russian leaders. Four members of the SEM were among them, who supposedly legally enjoyed immunity, and also over 100 prominent members of an organization that they had were all arrested. And on the same date, 80 prominent white Russians were imprisoned in Warsaw. This is on January 15, 1927. The headmasters and teachers of the white Russian schools were also arrested and dismissed, and the establishments closed because they had tried to become independent, I think. That's what's following. He's saying that they tried for independence. All this is following that. He says it was officially announced that the arrested men had been acting on behalf of the Comintern and had been engaged in revolutionary activities. The white Russian peasants replied with desultory demonstrations, at least the ones that were, had not been arrested. But they had no leaders now, and they were soon crushed. In a single day, there were 11 casualties at Kaso, to quote but one example, including 5 dead. The organization of the white Russians was then dissolved. 56 white Russian leaders were brought up for trial at Vilna at the end of February 1928. And more than a year after their arrest, they finally got to go to trial. I guess they were held in prison during that time. They included 4 members of the Polish parliament, the SEM. Roughly 600 witnesses appeared against them. After the case had lasted several months, 37 of the accused were sentenced to imprisonment for periods varying from 3 to 12 years. But the illegal organization of the White Russians is still alive. The men meet in secret. I was told some details, but only after I promised not to publish them, for the slightest hint as to the place concerned would, my informant said, lead to wholesale arrests and the ruin of thousands. But he quotes some English newspapers that are aware of what's going on and are writing some criticism of it, talking about the savage floggings of the peasants and the destruction of property. The Daily Herald, the Manchester Guardian, the Daily Express all wrote some things like this. And in England, there was criticism by 1930, of what was going on. We're supposed to think so highly of the English for speaking out, but, they didn't do anything. They were speaking out, but they didn't do anything. And now we're going to talk about the Germans. Further west, the method adopted against the minorities were marked by less physical brutality, but were nevertheless harsh. For example, the children of German-speaking parents in Upper Silesia who wished to attend German schools had to register between May 25th and 31st, 1926. Each child had to bring a statement in writing signed by the parent or guardian stating, "I declare that the child registered above belongs to the German language minority." He says that was not in accordance with the Geneva Convention. Only when no school existed in the area was a written application to be made, but this was simply overruled. Despite this, the number of applications was very large. I rather think that the Poles were honestly surprised. Some people say they only pretended to be, but I doubt it. I am prepared to accept their astonishment as real, the Germans did whatever they could to have their own schools, their German language schools. And then it goes on, but the methods adopted to reduce this total were unjust. Each parent or guardian was made to appear in person before the Polish authorities, who greeted them in Polish, precisely even though they were trying to have their German language honored, precisely 5,784 parents and guardians in the Katowice area were questioned, and the simple statements of the parents were not always accepted. It was then asserted that 145 of the children could not prove that they were Polish subjects, while 47 had applied to a school which was nearest their residence but not in the proper district. There were also others who were struck from the list. In 391 cases, the signatures were stated not to be correct. This was in the vast majority of cases because the mother had signed, whereas the Poles only accepted the mother's signature when the father was dead or was otherwise incapable of signing. I'm sure they didn't know that in advance, but the Poles said that. The subsequent statement of the fathers concerned that they were in agreement with the applications and would append their signature was not accepted. The applications were rejected. 1,307 pupils were struck from the list because the parents had failed to appear in person at the right time. 5,205 applications were rejected en masse, the claim being that they did not, in the opinion of the Polish authorities, belong to the minority. The total number of applications made by fathers, mothers, or guardians covered 8,560 children. Not less than 7,114 were not permitted to attend the German schools. Articles 75 and 131 of the Geneva Convention were thus not adhered to. By 1928, the number of applications in the area under discussion had fallen to about 2,500 as a result of the difficulties. See, that's how they stopped the people from asserting their rights. And then the German minority in the Katowice area was compelled to learn Polish at school and to give up the right to study at German schools. Yet the people of Katowice still speak German, as I have heard for myself. Even now, peace has not been restored. In the middle of July 1939, this is where he's speaking right now, he's writing this in the middle of July, or he's taking his notes or whatever. In the middle of July 1939, I saw more police there than I had observed in the whole of Warsaw, in this town of Katowice. And for the first time, I noticed mounted police. At one street corner, I even saw two mounted police who remained at their posts until relieved by two others. All day they remained there, perhaps all night as well, but I did not go to look. At the 1928 elections, the Germans and other minorities returned numerous representatives to the Sejm, but afterwards the lists of electors were revised. In the electorate at Chechen Bielitz, the whole list was declared to be out of order and 20,000 votes canceled by a stroke of the pen before the November elections of 1930. Some of the electors succeeded in registering their names for the new list, but for the most part, they were too late. The Polish authorities demanded that they should present a document affirming their Polish nationality. The police station was besieged, but in the few days left before the lists were closed, only a few of the electors could obtain these certificates, the remainder losing their votes as a result. See, they really tried to vote and assert, as I already said, their rights there, but they were just stopped in every which way for in this terrible kind of pointless rules that they pass. So a little bit more here. Those at work found it difficult to apply in the hours fixed. A certain regulation was then interpreted by the local authorities to mean that a vote could be made in secret. Listen to this. They interpreted a regulation to mean that a vote could be made in secret or openly as desired, and a notice was printed in the Katowice journal, Polska Zachodnia, that those who voted secretly would be regarded as enemies of the state. Terrorism followed, and persons known to be of German descent were beaten up. In 1930, the Germans lost about 100,000 votes in Upper Silesia alone. No one who voted for the German list could hope to escape attack. since the compartments in the election booths were torn down and the votes had to be made before the eyes of the supervising polls. Wow. On November 9, 1930, groups of Poles from other areas, accompanied by local guides, smashed the doors of German residents, entered their rooms, and broke up the furniture. Sleeping people were dragged from their beds. Those who had been wakened by the noise and who tried to save their property were beaten with sticks and rods. Some of the Germans escaped and appealed to the police, who, however, claimed that they could do nothing as their numbers were too small. 2 days later, a similar attack was made on the Germans in the village of Golazowicz. A free fight followed, but the Poles outnumbered the local inhabitants. This was reported in the Polish press as a revolt of the German-speaking inhabitants. The German Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Curtius, that's a guy from Germany, sent a request to the League of Nations asking for help for the minority. That was on November 27th. A second note followed on December 9th. But it was not until January 21st, 1931, that the League found time to discuss matters. The League used diplomatic but hard words and demanded that the position of the Germans be improved. This should be clear enough proof that the charges against the Poles were not unfounded. The League found them to be, accurate, or they wouldn't have said what they did if they were just made up. It was established that the Polish government had not even denied that such incidents had taken place. 255 cases were placed before the League. Small wonder that I found the people of Upper Silesia only speaking German in low tones or in private. Small wonder that they looked askance at strangers. One must ask whether it is in keeping with the rights of small nations or nationalities that they should thus be included in states where they are exposed to such treatment. Poland has tried to make the minorities relinquish their language and customs. She has failed despite more than 20 years of activities, such as I have described in this chapter. But the attempts are still going on. One begins to wonder whether the Ukrainians, White Russians, and Germans should not also enjoy some protection from England, or must it only be the Poles? Well, understatement there. Hey, Marcus, you want to come back on to help me close out the show?
Yeah, sure.
You know, okay, good. You know, naturally I've got a lot more. That's good stuff, but I'm going to stop here. I think that's I've tried to as you read this thing, right? I don't know if you finished it. There's lots of great quotes from famous people and all kinds of things in here. But the whole idea is that the Poles wanted to take on all these other people's territory, and they had to take the people along with it. And then they didn't want foreigners in their country. They wanted to turn everybody into Polish, but these people didn't want to be Poles. And they didn't want to belong to that country to begin with. And, you know, the Poles are not very well liked. They're, you know, when people get to know them, I mean, I'm not saying, again, that there aren't really nice Poles, and a lot of people who are Polish, like Polish-American and stuff, you know, they're so far removed from all of that. They're hardly, you know, they're more just Americans than anything else. So, you know, I don't mean to be demeaning everybody, but we talk about that time. Even now, though, I think the nation of Poland, as Poland, is not admirable in the least little bit, and it's not very popular. What is your opinion on how the rest of the world views Poland and Poles?
Well, I know that the Russians look at the Poles as bad relatives. That's how they say it.
Bad relatives. Yeah.
And the whole point of this information is that the Poles were not the, you know, peaceful people, you know, living next to Germany, and then all of a sudden Hitler decided to go in there for no reason, to take over the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what we've been sold, and unfortunately many Polish nationalists, they don't want to revise this narrative. They have a problem with that.
Yeah, my as I said in the beginning, and I like to keep some kind of focus going because it's easy to just start reading this and that and everything and get caught up with that. But I did want to have that focus that, you know, my entire concern is the reputation of Germany and what's being done to Germany today still, and with the blessing of the leaders of Germany. And you have to admit that, but they're not really the leaders. They're forced upon the Germans, and the Germans don't even know any better anymore. That they think they are their real leaders because they've been brought up with them. But you know, this whole idea that Hitler was the one who was so cruel to everybody, and it's just not true because everything. There's nothing that Hitler did that these Poles and others too. I want to go into the Czechs too. And the Rush, everybody did to other peoples, including Germans.
Interesting is these complaints, international complaints, were not started by Hitler. That happened during the Weimar years already.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not something made up. And then also the minorities in Germany, the French, the Danes, and later, after the Anschluss, possibly Hungarians. I don't know about the Hungarians, but I know that the French were treated well. There were about 100,000 French people in Germany, a minority, and they didn't have much trouble living in Germany.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, Germany has... And what I didn't really get into much was how helpful Germany actually was to Poland time and time again. And actually, I think it goes all the way back. Because I think this whole so-called Polish nation, Marcus, was people who grew under the sort of overarching or the oversight or something of the Germanic people, of the Germans, the German rulers and so on, and then these pagans or whatever, you know, from the East were around, and they slowly got Catholicized, and they got into the, and civilized and so on, and they developed, I think they became what they are with the help of Germany, and Germany was never harsh with that neighbor at all. It was always helpful. But the neighbor, the Poles, that is, once they developed, you know, their kind of idea that they were a nation, then they had this number of people there, and it seems pretty widespread, though, that just had dreams of glory and wanted to and imagine this large, great, powerful Poland. And I do believe that this great, powerful Poland in the past, I think was pretty much... it's pretty much mythology. I don't think it was what they try to make it out to be, that they had this great kingdom going on back whenever it was. They had something going on, but then another trait of Poles is this ingratitude. They just cannot show gratitude. They have to always say, yeah, but you didn't do enough. You didn't do this for us, and you did that to us. And that's their attitude, which is what I think is the very worst part of it, the very worst part of these people. Yeah, I know you try to be more diplomatic than I am. I'm angry. Angry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's reason to be angry. I think the new Poland, the state of Poland, was basically a vassal state of the allies, of the Versailles allies.
Well,
they,
there you
they
go.
Made it,
well,
they
know that fits in with it being a vassal state of the German kingdoms and so on back in the early days, and then later they're a vassal state of the allies. So they've always been a vassal state. They never really were able to push through and create their own. They made efforts at it. But they kept failing, right? And so they've always depended on the help of others to give them what they want. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
True.
At all? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of a defining characteristic there, and maybe that makes them resentful because they can't point to their own great achievements and what achievements they have been a part of. They overemphasize. They get megalomania about it, and they overrate what they've accomplished, what they've done.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays they have their state, and still a problem, you know, to have a functioning state. They get lots of money from the West, and on top, many Poles, you know, go to Germany, Britain, and work there, you know. So if they're such a great people, then, I don't want to take it away from them, but then they got to make it happen, you know what I mean?
Well, that's right, you know, and they're just not a great people. They're not a great people, but they're a part of Europe. They're a white people. I don't know. I just wonder if they're too Jewified. I swear, to me, the closest thing to Jews is Poles. I mean, Jews first, Jews are the worst, and then after that, Poles have a lot of those same characteristics that Jews have. I don't know how they got it. But I think it may be partly just the way they developed, in that they never could accomplish what they imagined, what they wanted to, you know. And so they kind of got grandiose, you know, and they invented things. And you know that the Elsa Loser page, that long page on the first mm-hmm. one that we're looking at, falsifications of Polish history.
Yeah, I read that whole thing.
It shows there's all kinds of invention going on. So they make things up, and the Jews do the same thing. And when you do that, you're just in trouble. You know, I mean, you can't do that and really get anywhere. It's a handicap. So
yeah, the thing with Danzig, it's Danzig in German and Gdansk in Polish. But it has Dan or Dan in its core. So is that originally a Danish city? That's what I heard from someone who is actually Danish. She told me that.
Who knows? It's way up there in the north. Yeah, lots of things could have been happening. I mean, I don't know all that old history.
I'm just saying that the East Germanic languages, they're entirely extinct, and they were spoken in that area, Poland, and then down Ukraine, not all of Ukraine, but parts. And why are they extinct? Why is nobody speaking it anymore? I don't know, but that's the question.
Well, what do you think about Elsa's Loser's premise that they invented the Polish language for the Poles in the early, what?
Well, that's possible. As I said, what they did with French, you know, French basically is when the Romans came, they spoke Latin or Italian, I guess Latin back then. And then the peasants developed basically French, which is, in Germany we call it Bauernfranzösisch, you know, farmer French, or Bauern Latein, farmer Latin. So that's how the French language developed. I'm not an expert. Maybe it's, I don't know, it's just speculation. Maybe it's a mix of Russian and Latin, I don't know. Someone mm-hmm. else who knows about languages might know that or might figure it out. Yeah.
Well, you know, we have to close this up. So say your last thoughts here, and I just want to say that, you know, I'm just trying to find a way to get make some progress against all this horrible propaganda against the Germans, and a lot of it comes from Poland. As we know, the Poles are very invested in the anti-German World War II story. So what do you want to say before we go?
I can only agree, and I'm looking forward for the next show on this topic. It's very interesting, and I'm also looking forward what people say on both sides, you know, to face the facts and discuss and be honest.
Yeah,
and
let's hope for some a lot of commenting about this. And you know, there's the one thing I want to do in an upcoming show is that is all the conflict between the Poles and the Ukrainians in the early 40s during the war. And I mean, in Volhynia, I have a lot of information on that. I was always going to do a show on it, and I never did. And I looked for it today, and I found it. So we're going to talk about that one of these days coming up. It's maybe next week, because it fits right in with what we're talking about now. But what brutality these people showed each other. Man, they were really fierce at what they did to one another. Well, the nationalists. Okay, thanks.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Ladies
thanks
and gentlemen, good night from the Heretics Hour. We will be back again next week with another installment in this subject, it looks like. So take care and see you later.